This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney about her return from a Free Gaza delegation.
A Free Gaza delegation that never made it to Gaza, but made it to an Israeli jail.
We'll learn how private contractors, mercenaries, and the war profiteers in Afghanistan and Pakistan outnumber U.S. soldiers.
One reason we don't need a draft is private contractors. We pay and we pay and we pay. There's more private contractors than there are U.S. soldiers now in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We'll hear special insights on the Honduran coup, which ousted President Manuel Zelaya.
Is Hillary crying crocodile tears about the coup in Honduras?
Stay with us.
Today we want to update you once again on what's happened to the Bush excesses in the so-called war on terror. The question is, what has Obama done and what has he changed? In this update, we'll look at two issues. One is the issue of military commissions, and the other is preventive detentions. Military commissions, as you recall, were the special kind of rump trials that have been held sporadically almost since 9/11. In a seven-year period, only three of them have been held. One was a guilty plea, one person essentially got time served, and likewise, with the third person. So they haven't worked very well, and twice they've been held illegal or unconstitutional by the court. And our hopes were that military commissions, which really watered down fundamental due process rights, would be thrown out with Obama. But unfortunately, no such luck. In fact, last week, the Senate Armed Services Committee held a hearing in which people from the Obama administration, David Chris and Jed Johnson, both people who work for Obama, testified in favor of military commissions and said they were going to give them some more bells and whistles. Those are my words. But they were trying to say, we're going to try and make them comply with due process. Incredibly enough, Daryl Vandeveld, a former prosecutor who was involved in military commissions, said, forget about it. Use federal criminal trials. Forget about military commissions. They'll be held unconstitutional by the courts again, and by that time we'll have had people serve 9 years without a trial. So you might ask, what's wrong with military commissions? Well, what's wrong is the very reason that they're being used is because they're easier for the government to convict. That's what happens when you make up the rules after the facts. When you make up the rule after the alleged crime has been committed, you slant the rules. You slant them heavily in favor of conviction, and that's what happens here. So the first question is, what's going to be admitted as evidence? You're going to be able to put in hearsay evidence. That's evidence that can't be cross-examined. That wouldn't fly in a federal court trial in the United States. Secondly, they're still arguing over to what extent so-called confessions have to be, quote, voluntary, or to what extent they have to be coerced. So again, that wouldn't fly in a federal court. Federal courts require voluntary confessions. And in a third aspect that really makes these military commissions as proposed by the Obama administration or by the Senate Armed Services Committee, led by the so-called liberal senator, Senator Levin, what makes them the same as the Bush administration is that even if a person is acquitted by these so-called military commissions, they can still be held as enemy combatants after the fact. So you might ask, what's the difference? The answer is, to a defendant facing a military commission, there is none. Very little. A little more so-called due process, if you want to call it that. But in the end, what was formerly Bush's policy on military commissions is sadly, looks like it's going to be Obama's policy on military commissions. The only thing that's being argued about now is whether the Obama administration is going to set the rules or the Senate Armed Services Committee is going to pass legislation to set the rules. Either way, the rules are tilted heavily in favor of conviction. So that's not a good sign going forward. A second major issue that the Center for Constitutional Rights and many other civil liberties organizations opposed during the Bush administration was Guantanamo, but really Guantanamo as to what it stood for in the sense that it stood for and incorporated a preventive detention scheme. The government, the Bush administration, held people at Guantanamo for over 7 years without giving them any trial, but simply gave them some kind of a rump hearing as to whether they were dangerous or not, and whether they could be released, and whether they were enemy combatants, but not really a criminal trial. They felt that under their claims of war power, that they could simply hold people indefinitely or forever until the so-called war with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or terrorism was over. Once again, we hope that the Obama administration would end preventive detention. And I recall writing an article in The Nation a couple of weeks before Obama took office saying, don't rewrap Guantanamo. Don't simply continue it in another location as a preventive detention scheme with some more legality, so-called legality, surrounding it, whether by Congress or by executive order. Sadly, I'm here to tell you that right now it looks like they will be incorporating a preventive detention scheme going forward. The debate is no longer between the civil libertarians who oppose preventive detention, like the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU, but now it's between those who think it should be done by executive order versus those who think it should be done by Congress. Neither one is correct. It should not be done at all. Preventive detention, really historically, is where you hold people again, as I've said, without charges and without trial. If you look at an aspect of the long historical fight for the struggle for human liberty, you can characterize that fight as a fight against preventive or arbitrary detention, a fight against what King John was forced not to do, which is throw people in a prison and never bring them to trial and never charge them. That's what the Magna Carta was all about. And sadly, Obama now is going down that road of preventive detention. It always reminds me, and I occasionally wanted to use these words, of the speech that Anthony gave when he buried Caesar in Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar. As I'm sure you all remember, it begins, "Friends, Romans, and countrymen, I have come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones, and so let it be with Caesar." I'm sad to say that after the Obama administration leaves office, the good will be gone, but the evil of military commissions and preventive detention, and of course the failure to hold accountable the torture conspirators, will live long after them and will really be the equivalent of driving a stake through the heart of democracy.
A Free Gaza delegation ship, hoping to deliver humanitarian supplies, was stopped by the Israeli Navy earlier this month. Among the nearly 100 U.S. peace activists was former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney and Irish peace activist and Nobel laureate Myreed McGuire. McKinney and others had been in custody since Tuesday of last week, but could have been released earlier if they signed a document admitting they violated Israel's blockade. We're joined today by Cynthia McKinney to get the details on the seizure.
Congresswoman McKinney, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
As I said, it's a surprise to have you back, but we're glad. Not a surprise. We knew you'd get back, but I know you were in Israeli jail. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how you wound up in an Israeli jail? What were you doing there?
My mother would be interested in my response to that question as well. Quite an unusual thing, I think, for anyone to get a glimpse inside an Israeli prison. And so there were 21 of us on the Free Gaza boats. The Free Gaza movement had been able to get two boats, the Free Gaza, which they were going to leave in Gaza as a replacement for the fishermen boats that had been taken away from the Palestinian fishermen. And then there was the Ariane, which also was known as the Spirit of Humanity. As it turned out, the Free Gaza boat was not allowed to set sail. And so the 21 of us then embarked upon our journey in the Spirit of Humanity boat.
How big is that boat?
Well, it's really just a ferry. And while you could tell that the volunteers had put a lot of love in refurbishing the boat with the paint and, you know, putting hooks in and making it a sort of a livable place for a 30-hour journey, which is the length of time that it would take that ferry. And the ferry was so slow that, honestly, I could walk faster than the ferry went.
But where does it leave from, Cynthia?
It leaves from Larnaca, Cyprus. That boat won't be leaving from anywhere anymore because it was destroyed by the Israeli military. They took some kind of huge magnetic item that held the boat, the ferry, in suspension and then shook it violently.
Oh my gosh, did you see that actually?
I didn't see that, but one of our Free Gaza 21 saw it.
Okay, so let me go back. You get on this boat in Cyprus, and it's 30 hours. Was it rough? Is it sunny? Is there a place to sleep on the boat? What happens?
It was the most unusually calm day on the sea that I think anyone had experienced. It was absolutely beautiful. Then we were on the sea for approximately 37 hours because the estimated length of the trip, if we had been able to make it to our destination, was 30 hours. But with the Israeli intercept, they did something that was unusual. They did not take us directly to Ashdod port, which is where we ended up. They took us in a very circuitous route. Now, of course, I would not have known that, but we had people on the boat who had successfully made it to Gaza before by boat, so they knew the route. What they came back and said to us was that this was most unusual, and they are wondering if the Israelis have not already started mining the natural gas that has been discovered in the Palestinian waters off of Gaza.
So you're sitting on this boat with how many other people, Cynthia?
20 other people.
And what's the first hint you had that you might not get to Gaza?
Oh, gosh, we didn't know that we weren't going to get to Gaza until they actually boarded the boat.
So how far off the Israeli coast, roughly, were you when you saw the Israeli craft and they boarded the boat?
Well, while we were still in international waters, the Israelis had threatened us. It was nighttime. They threatened us, and they did something that they didn't do with the Dignity. Remember, I was on board the Dignity when they rammed it.
I remember that, right.
Right. Well, this time, they disabled the GPS. They sort of provided an escort, according to the captain, they provided an escort for the boat trying to push us into Israeli waters, but our captain is a professional. So that tactic didn't work. They also utilized something that I've never seen before, like some wave-making machine, because they literally shook us. They shook us up and down and up and down, and the GPS was also turned off. All communications were disrupted. I think that also was an effort to disorient us, to get us off course.
Let me go back for a second. They boarded the boat to get rid of the GPS, or they did that?
No. They did that prior to the boarding.
They did these wave machines or whatever, and they disoriented the GPS before they even boarded.
Yes, that's correct. I think they were trying to get us into, by accident, Israeli water so they could, you know, say that we had made a mistake and we weren't on course. But that did not happen. So then they had to regroup, and they just sat and waited for us to enter Gazan territorial waters. And we were in mile 19 of Gaza's territorial waters, which extend 20 miles out. That's when these four speedboats came very quickly. As I said, our ferry was so slow. They approached us very quickly, and then eight soldiers dressed like ninjas with the ski mask, the faces completely hidden from us. They commandeered the boat, ejected the captain from the captain's chair, and then they took over the boat. And as they were driving the boat, it was almost as if I felt that they were trying to damage the boat while they were driving the boat because they drove it too fast and they drove it so roughly. The seas, it was almost kind of spiritual in a way that while we were driving the boat, the seas were so calm. And then when they took over the boat, the seas became very rough and things began, glass was shattering, things were falling off. And it was almost as if they were doing this on purpose because they didn't stop. I did ask them to stop. One of the more poignant moments after they boarded the boat, they rounded us all up, put us in one room, told us to sit down and shut up. We had to hand over all of our belongings to them. And right now, all of the belongings had not yet been returned to everyone, even though now we're all out, so we'll never see those. But there was one soldier who looked at one of the other American women the other American woman and said, you know, what's in that bag? He was chastising her because she had failed to turn it over. Well, she didn't think very much of it. When he challenged her, she said, crayons. He didn't understand her. So he said, what did you say? And she said, crayons for the children. And he had his gun pointed at her. She said that at that moment, his eyes touched her eyes. You know, they looked at each other. He looked at her in the eyes and lowered his gun. And it was almost as if for that moment, he thought to himself, you know, why am I doing this? All they have is crayons.
When they boarded, there were eight, you said, ninja types, and they had what kind of weapons?
Big guns.
They were big guns, right.
big guns, little guns, some kind of arrow or something, you know, I don't know.
Oh, my gosh.
Maybe a harpoon or...
Wow.
They were very well outfitted, and this is the thing, you know, this is all provided by U.S. taxpayers. These are the gifts that our government makes available to Israel, and then they use them against people who are taking crayons for children.
We basically supply almost entirely the Israeli military.
That's right. Yeah. And people need to know that. And I've called several times for the Congress not to pass any appropriation bill that has money or weapons for the Israeli military. I've called on President Obama not to sign any appropriation bill, and we just continue to make the call.
That's for sure. Now, let's get you back on the boat. So they board the boat. You guys are all in a room. Let me ask you one question. How frightened were you or were others, but you in particular?
Well, of course, we didn't know what they were going to do to us, but we understood that we were putting our lives on the line. We understood that when we left Larnaca, and particularly after what happened with the Dignity.
Right after you were rammed earlier in another effort, you realized anything could happen on this, really, anything.
That's right. That's right. So we recognized that anything could happen. Of course, we hoped for the better, and we did everything that we could contacting the White House. I personally contacted the White House several times, contacted the Secretary of State's office by email several times, contacted. And then finally, they made the decision. We presume that they got an order to go ahead and board. So they did that. And we were taken by this very circuitous route to Ashdod Port, and we were in the hands of the military. And basically, the military can do whatever they want to do. They can take whatever they want to take. All you can do is say, we want our things back, but because it is the military, they have the final say in what they do. We were forced to emerge from the boat with our hands up in the air.
Amazing.
Prisoners, you know, and some were handcuffed.
Some people were handcuffed?
Yes, they were handcuffed because the Israeli soldiers were very rough with Marid McGuire, who observed them take down one of the women. I didn't observe that, but she observed it, and she protested.
Of course, she's the Nobel Peace Prize winner from Ireland, right?
Yeah, she's a big threat, you know.
right.
The soldiers, she protested to the soldiers. The soldiers then roughed her up with bad language, and, you know, it was a scene. And the men came to her rescue, and those men who came to her rescue got handcuffed.
I got you. Okay, so after you get off at the port, did they try and interview you? Did they take you to a prison? What did they do?
They basically told us that we had violated the law, and they took us into custody. They did full body searches on us. They had the women to search us. We didn't have to remove our clothing, but that was just their choice. On previous occasions, I'm told, every kind of search you can imagine has been done. So we were lucky that we only got the body search with our clothes on. We were held by the military for several hours. They transferred us over. Some people were allowed to see their things. Some people were not allowed to see their things. And then they transferred us to a detention facility.
What day of the week was this, Cynthia?
Oh, gosh. We were apprehended by the Israelis on the 30th of June. I arrived in the U.S. yesterday, and we were released, at midnight yesterday.
That would be Tuesday, July 7th.
That's correct.
Right. So you were in for quite a while. You were in custody for half a dozen days, almost a week.
Yes. We were transferred from the detention center to the prison, the full prison.
Where was the prison? In the same town, Ashdod?
No. The prison is called Romley Prison, and it's somewhere near Tel Aviv.
Were you kept with the others or kept with other women? What was the prison like?
We were mixed in with the prison population.
And the prison population is mostly Israeli or also Israeli-Palestinian or what?
No, it was amazing, at least where we were. These were all young women of African and Asian descent.
Really?
There was one Russian woman, and there was one woman from Moldova.
Oh, my gosh. Do you happen to know what they were doing there? I mean, in the prison. I don't know why they were in Israel, but...
Yes, they were in prison because they didn't have valid visas or it was some immigration problem.
Right. In fact, I understand now that in Israel, that rather than employ Palestinians or Israeli-Palestinians, what Israel is doing is essentially getting immigrants from the rest of the world rather than give Palestinians jobs.
Many of the women said to us that they responded to ads. The ads were for employment. This was back in Ethiopia. There is this active recruitment of others, and I presume for the Filipinas as well, there was an active recruitment.
I think that's right. Now, let's get you, you're in the prison. How did you ever get yourself out of the prison? Were there conditions on your release? Did they try and get conditions on your release?
Well, the system was very interesting in that the Israelis did not want us to meet with our attorneys, and they actively blocked our efforts to meet with our attorneys. It was only because one of the Free Gaza 21 knew the attorneys and recognized the attorney when she saw him inside the building, when she went outside for a smoke, that we even knew that the attorneys were inside the building looking for us. So when it was my turn to go and meet with the Ministry of Interior, I told the gentleman, the representative, I know that our attorneys are here, and you've denied us the opportunity even to meet with them.
That's wonderful.
And it was only after that we were able to meet for a maximum of 10 minutes. Now, not everybody got 10 minutes to meet with the attorney. That was another farce. We were given documents by the Israeli authorities. They tried to get us to sign one document. That document was in English, but it was a confession that we had broken the law. So, of course, we weren't going to sign that document because we didn't break any law except loving our fellow human beings and respecting their human rights.
Good for you, Cynthia.
Yes, but then, interestingly, other documents that were given to us were given to us in Hebrew. Now, just imagine those innocent young Ethiopian or Filipina women who the Filipinas would speak English, but the Ethiopian women don't speak Hebrew and they don't speak English. And the documents that are given to them are given to them in Hebrew. What kind of justice is that?
Not much, that's for sure. How did you get out finally?
Well, the deportation process ran its course, and we were deported. We were held in prison for being in a country that we didn't intend to enter, and we were deported from that country. Even though we had no intention of entering that
country. You're forcibly taken to a country you didn't want to enter, and then they deport you from that country because you illegally entered it. Nice. So maybe they should deport the people who took you in.
Or prosecute them.
Yeah, right, exactly. So they deported you almost a week later, and then you flew back from where to where? From Tel Aviv to New York?
From Tel Aviv to New York, and then from New York to Washington, D.C. I missed my son's first day in law school.
I'm sorry to hear that, but congratulations having a son in law school. How do you look at the movement to open Gaza? I know that there's people who've gone in through land, through the Rafah entrance. Some people have been turned back at the Israeli entrance. Your boat now twice you have been unable to get in, although I think the stir you've caused has been very, very important toward bringing attention to Gaza. But what's your thinking now politically?
Well, in terms of the Free Gaza movement, and of course, you know, I cannot speak for them, but I think that they have no intention of stopping. They view correctly that it is a right of the Palestinians to have access to their territorial waters. That is the purpose of the Free Gaza commitment to going in by sea. The Palestinians should not have to ask the Israelis for anything. They have those miles of territorial waters that should be open to them and to their fishermen, by the way, without the boats being confiscated. But it's clear that there are tremendously important natural gas deposits that are there that have been discovered. And who knows that perhaps contracts have already been let. We don't know.
So the struggle continues, and we're really proud to have you on our show. Cynthia, you've done some amazing work as a congresswoman, as well as afterwards. You haven't let any grass grow under your feet.
I was supposed to be writing a book, and I went to Haiti and updated what I had already done. I think I need to go back to Haiti now because I have another chapter.
You've been writing in Haiti? Really? That's great.
Yes.
A place very close to my heart. So, you know, I remember once, and I'll end on this sort of, unless you have any other comment, that someone wrote a book on our representation of the Haitian Guantanamo people many years ago in the early 90s under Aristide. And I said, there's no good politicians that I ever knew except for Cynthia McKinney. So,
oh, my goodness. You
so Cynthia, we miss you dearly there, but we're really glad that you're in the thick of it all.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience.
Thank you, Cynthia. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Since President Obama announced the strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan in late March of this year, news of troop deployment drone attacks, and the killing of innocent Afghani and Pakistani civilians is heard nearly every week. Private contractors, mercenaries, and the war profiteers in the region rarely make headlines, however. One study has concluded that private contractors and mercenaries outnumber U.S. soldiers. To talk more about what is going on behind the scenes in Afghanistan, we're joined by Pratap Chatterjee, who has recently returned from Afghanistan. Pratap is a journalist and the former executive director of CorpWatch, an Oakland-based corporate accountability organization. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start by talking about what President Obama's plan is and how that differs from the Bush administration.
Well, President Obama's plan in Afghanistan, in fact, as well as in Iraq, is actually a continuation of what President Bush has done. There's been some refinements around the edges. It's the same Secretary of Defense, and in terms of contractors, in terms of, you know, drone attacks, you know, in terms of habeas corpus, as you guys well know, it actually isn't that very different. He has also inherited a system, and also, since we're about to talk about contractors, inherited some long-term contracts that are 5-year, 10-year contracts that he can't easily cancel or give up, because it will basically mean the whole system will shut down. For every soldier in Iraq, there's a contractor. For every soldier in Afghanistan, there are two contractors. So that's an awful lot of people. Now, some of these people, these are not Blackwater men, you know, out with guns, you know, shooting civilians. A lot of these are janitors, you know, they're cooks, they're builders. They're mostly from India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Egypt, Bosnia. And they do the dull and dirty work that nobody else wants to do. I mean, the U.S. had a draft army in the 1960s in Vietnam, and they used soldiers to do this dirty work. Now, because they have a volunteer army, they employ Indians for $300 a month to cook and clean and wash dishes and clean toilets and that sort of thing.
Is that the average salary?
It starts there on a base in Iraq. It's even lower if you're on a base in Kuwait. If you're an Indian Bangladeshi worker, let's say, I met Bangladeshi workers when I was embedded in a base in Kuwait, they were starting about $100 a month. And it can go up very high. I mean, at the top end of the scale, you've got the sort of Blackwater types and the interrogator types. You have contract interrogators who are making as much as $250,000 a year. You have actually translators who are making more than General Petraeus was, making about $180,000 starting salary, because translators are in very high demand, and the U.S. needs a lot of them. They need 10,000 in Iraq, Afghanistan, Guantanamo Bay, and they can't find enough people.
But if we look at the raw numbers, you're saying it's 1-to-1 in Iraq, which would be, what are there, 130,000 or so troops left in Iraq?
There's about 130,000 troops. There were, the last time we checked, about 175,000 contractors. So it's actually more.
More contractors. And in Afghanistan, what are the numbers today?
There were 30,000 troops about a year ago, and there were 71,000 contractors, if I've got the numbers right. I could be off by a couple of thousand here or there. And remember, of course, the number of soldiers is increasing. The bulk of these people, cooks, cleaners, people working in reconstruction, building hospitals, schools, and things like that, not people with guns. There is a small number of people that are heavily armed, probably around 5,000, you know, that are like the Blackwater Guards, you know, that are out there and have the potential to and have killed civilians, as I'm sure listeners are aware, the famous December 2007 shooting in Nisr Square. And you have people like in Abu Ghraib who are doing interrogation.
So there's still interrogators out there, private contractor interrogators, in both Iraq and Afghanistan?
Absolutely, because there are, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but they have an order of about 15,000 prisoners in each country that are under somewhat under U.S. control. And therefore, when the Americans want to interrogate these guys, they need translators to translate for them. But remember, for every interrogator, military interrogator, you have a contract interrogator. The new company that runs it is right here in New York City. It's a company called L3 on 37th and 3rd Avenue.
And that's Titan, was formerly L3?
No. L3 is actually a much bigger company that bought up Titan.
Gotcha.
So L3 is a company that's about probably 15 years old. And they're in the top 8 defense contractors in the country, but most people haven't heard about them because they don't make aircraft. They make systems for aircraft. They, you know, Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon all competing on a contract, you know, they can't all make the same very intricate, you know, missile guidance system. So they subcontract to a company that's as big as them, and that's L3. L3 has gone about buying a lot of intelligence contractors, such as Titan. Titan's the company that provided the translator. So Titan has got subsumed into L3. Now, Titan didn't do a very good job by military standards, which meant the main reason they were faulted was they weren't providing enough qualified translators to the U.S. military. So the U.S. military tried to get a new contractor, and Titan and L3 fought very bitterly for probably about 4 years. They finally lost the contract about a year ago when I was last in Iraq in April of 2008. And now two new companies have taken over.
Titan was the company that was involved in Abu Ghraib, right?
Now, that's absolutely right. So Titan, the Adel Nakla, for example, the Egyptian, I think,
right.
Who's accused of human rights abuse, shall we say. There's a lot more detail. Clearly, he denies it. And there's a lawsuit that Susan Burke and yourself are working on, I think.
Is that correct?
Yeah. So, but they're gone. Titan is gone. There's a new company that was set up by Spider Marks, who was the J2, the guy in charge of intelligence in the invasion of Iraq. He set up a joint venture called Global Linguist Solutions with DynCorp, the police training company, and they hired a new set of translators a year ago. Now, the problem is, remember, Titan was failing to find enough translators. So when GLS comes, they can't hire a new 7,000 people. They hired and kept the same translators there. So Titan doesn't exist anymore in Iraq. They don't exist anymore in Afghanistan. Instead, it's GLS and MEP. But it's the same people. It's even the same management. They're operating the same contract, paying the translators less. So the average translator, local national in Iraq and Afghanistan, when I was just there in Afghanistan 2 months ago, I met probably a dozen of these translators. And remember, these are contractors, but they have the most dangerous jobs of anybody. Remember, they go out with the soldiers every single day, and then they go home. So let's just assume these guys, all they're doing is translating. They're not, you know, spies or any such thing. But they are seen by other people in the community going to an American base and coming back. They get targeted. Their families get targeted. They die, by my estimation, at a rate 50% higher than the soldiers they accompany.
These are the translators to accompany the soldiers in Afghanistan in particular.
In Iraq, the official figures are about 250 translators killed. My understanding is that, in fact, the company is underreporting. It's closer to 500. Half of them, you know, actually come from the communities that they're translating in. So they can be targeted the next day, the next year, 10 years down the road.
Are they almost all nationals?
I believe the figure is probably a little over half of them are local nationals who are paid at a rate of about between $700 and $1,100 a month to do translation. If you have a green card, you get paid a lot more. You start at around $15,000 a month.
Wow, really?
And the tragedy,
I guess, because it's dangerous also.
Because it's dangerous.
But of course, that doesn't help the Afghan. It helps the
Americans. It helps the Americans or the green card holders
right.
who are back here. And let me give you an example, because I was just from about a year ago, I was in a military base somewhere in Iraq. And we heard, you know, this thing they call the giant voice that said, you know, incoming missile, but, you know, mortars hitting, etc. So I turned to this translator from Southern California. I said, how do you say incoming missile in Arabic? And this look of panic descended upon him because he had no idea how to say it. He hadn't studied that in class back in Southern California. So he goes over to this Yemeni guy. There's a whole group of Titan translators. And he says, how do you say incoming missile in Arabic? The problem was the Yemeni translator didn't speak English. So this Lebanese guy has to get in and translate between the two of them. The Americans, the Iraqis, the Afghans die. People are targeted because of simple miscommunications. But this is a big problem. There is a standard that's written into the contract. It's called the Interagency Language Roundtable Standards. And under those standards, when L3, Titan, MEP provides translators, they're supposed to meet this minimum qualification. But they don't, because the company doesn't even test them on that. One of the reasons for that is the contract says, and this is where, you know, you start to understand why the contracting is such a problem, is it's very hard to monitor these contracts and penalize these people. When the company is told, if you provide 7,000 translators, we'll pay you and we'll give you a profit. If you provide 6,000 translators, in the contract they say, we'll penalize you for that. So you lose your profit. They force them to provide as many contracts as they can. Of course, maximize their profits, limits the penalty. So they hire anybody and everybody they can. And that has a huge impact, you know, on the soldiers. I know people who work in what's called DOCX. It's document exploitation. They pick up intelligence in the field. They papers, they translate it. It gets, you know, it gets coded and sent off to the United States. And, you know, and then they track down terrorists and bomb them or whatever. But the soldiers that I talked to said the materials coming into DOCX, the translation, is no good. These people don't actually speak either Arabic or English. Why is that so? Well, because Titan, we believe, you know, allegedly cheated on those tests. They didn't even test the people. They brought people in without testing them and said qualified, 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 because they could maximize the
profits. Does that mean that information could be going back to people who are making targeting decisions that are inaccurate?
Yes.
Now tell us, if people want to hear more about contractors, where do they go?
Sure. A couple of places. CorpWatch, CorpWatch.org. And that's where my articles are mostly published. There's quite a few that are on Tom Dispatch, Tom Engelhardt's blog. I have a book, a couple of books actually,
right.
A new book, Halliburton's Army, which is just about military logistics, out from Nation Books. A previous book, which is about 5 years old, called Iraq, Inc. And I would actually really encourage people, if you're interested in interrogation and translation and the use of contractors in military intelligence, is to look for a report on the CorpWatch website that was co-released with Amnesty, looking at human rights and contractors in the field of intelligence and linguistics. And it's called Outsourcing Intelligence in Iraq.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us. It's an amazing work, and your travels are completely remarkable to me. How you get embedded in all these places, I have no idea, but you do.
Smoltry is very nice to me.
All right. Thank you very much for being with
us. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Hadi.
Two weeks after the Honduran coup, ousted President Manuel Zelaya was prevented from returning to the country. Today we will look deeper into the life of Zelaya, his background among the landowning class, and his shift into a reform-minding leader that had more in common with Venezuela's Chavez and Bolivia's Evo Morales. As a result, he soon had the support of labor unions and social organizations that put him at odds with the social elite. Today we talk with Roger Burbeck about what led to the coup and the role the United States is currently playing in possibly restoring Zelaya to Honduras. Roger is the author of The Pinochet Affair and director of the Center for the Study of the Americas, based in Berkeley, California. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Roger.
Good to be with you.
I've known you for years as an expert on Latin America, Central America as well. And I know you just came out with a recent article on the coup in Honduras, and I'm interested in some of the perspectives you brought out in the article. Zelaya, I know, had a meeting with Hillary when he came out of Honduras, and of course the U.S. has taken the position they're against the coup, but really to tell us what is going on there, I mean, it just seems like a soap opera to me, and I don't understand that. I don't understand the news we're getting.
First of all, the coup, in which it still is carried by the mainstream press, was supposedly done to stop Zelaya from trying to achieve re-election. Zelaya was not advocating re-election. Zelaya wanted to have a separate ballot in the November presidential elections so that they could have a new constituent assembly to draft a new constitution for the country. The existing constitution was drafted in 1982, a very repressive constitution, when the U.S. ambassador was working with the death squads. John Negroponte was working with the death squads in 1982 and 83, when the military and the civilian leadership drafted a new, very authoritarian constitution. And Zelaya, and he looked toward the processes here in Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador, which carried out constituent assemblies, which recently basically changed the whole legal infrastructure and social infrastructure for the country for reforms and some radical reforms. And this is what he was proposing. He wanted to have just a plebiscite on a ballot on this Sunday when he was unceremoniously deposed. They wanted to have a ballot then to see whether people wanted to vote for a constituent assembly in November elections of this year for the presidential elections. It was not about re-election. The elites and the propagandists extracted from this, that one of the clauses in these other countries' constitutions is the president can serve from re-election. And that might have been a clause, but the clause in the Constitution would not have taken effect until they had drafted the Constituent Assembly, which would be well after he legally left office in January by whoever won the presidential elections in November this year.
I think that's a really strong point, Roger, that you have to read carefully to get it, but I'm glad to hear you say it, that he would not have been affected in any kind of positive way by whatever a referendum or a new constitution said. He'd be out of office.
He would be out of office. He could run for re-election probably after the constitution came into. That would be a year or two away. These processes all take 1 year or 2 years to take effect if we're drafting a new constitution for the country.
Let me ask you another question. I know what you've said now about the U.S. so-called brokering this negotiation and what's going to happen in that isn't going to be good for democracy or Zelaya. But I'm interested in your perspective on to what extent was the U.S. aware of the coup, do you think? And to what extent did they give it a green light?
When Hillary came down for the OAS meeting, I believe on June 2nd of this year, the Organization of American States had their big annual meeting there. She met with Zelaya. Did not like him personally because he dragged her in to meet his extended family.
Yeah, just stay on that for a second. I read that in the Times also, that apparently in the other room he had not only his immediate family, his extended family. I can't understand why would she be offended by that. Nothing made any sense to me in that. What is that about?
Well, it was that she is Secretary of State and probably didn't want to waste a day of time with these third world leaders. They aren't important for her.
It had to be a 10-minute handshake. I mean, what are we talking about?
She flew out the next day, actually, to be with Obama in the Middle East when he gave his speech and was carrying on diplomacy in Egypt. So she just wanted to get in and get out. Latin America isn't important for her. But at the same time, Zelaya openly brought up the fact that he wanted to vote on a new constituent assembly, these new elections. And Hillary expressed the opinion, apparently, that she thought this would violate the Constitution, be unconstitutional. So immediately when he presented to her in a very open way, she already looked askance at it and said this isn't the way to go. They wanted to maintain the old. Of course, any constitution which is drafted in a new constitution violates the old constitution, but he was doing it through popular democratic processes. And she already was opposed to it at that point, had an inclination and openly expressed that she was worried about the process. The Army, because of its historic relations going back to the 1980s in particular, when they were, and then the Contras were trained and run out of Honduras against Nicaragua in the Sandinista Revolution. The U.S. has the strongest military presence of any Central American country in Honduras right now, working closely with the military team. Probably the U.S. intelligence community knew about the coup impending and did nothing to stop it. My sense is that if Obama had been officially informed of it, he probably would have put the brakes to it. And he publicly has expressed his wording has been much more stronger in supporting the restoration of Zelaya than those of Hillary.
If they restore Zelaya, he's going to be restored with handcuffs. I think that's what's going on with Arias and negotiations. They're going to put him in there. They're not going to have a referendum. He's going to serve one term, and that's going to be the end. That's my guess. I don't know.
The best that thing happened, as you guys can imagine, is that Zelaya would be restored until his term expires in January. Formally expires.
Yeah, that's what I agree. And with no real power, with no referendum.
No, with no real power whatsoever. He just serves out 4 or 5 months, however many months. And even that, I'm dubious that he's going to be allowed that.
Yeah, I am too. Now, why would they give a hang about Honduras? Why would the U.S. give a hang about it? I mean, yeah, we cared about the Sandinistas, and that was a genuine revolution going on. We care about Venezuela. We care somewhat about Peru, a little bit about Ecuador. But Honduras? I mean, you and I have been to Honduras, Roger.
Well, it's a strategic military country and another way position of the U.S. empire, and strong position. The U.S. empire is the strongest position they have in Central America right now. And it just goes back to the fact that you and I both know there's a division between the different types of governments coming to power, three levels of government. One is the radical countries, which I consider, Cuba as well is leading, but the new radical, new left radical leaders, which is Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales of Bolivia, and Rafael Correa of Ecuador. These are the four with Cuba are the four radical countries of Latin American new left and forging entirely new policies. And you have the reformist governments of Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and to some extent Chile, maybe perhaps El Salvador. and the U.S. wants to drive a leverage between this. As of the present moment, as of the moment of the coup, Zelaya was allied with the radical countries.
Most even leftists in the U.S. probably were not aware of that.
It was allied in taking the country more in that direction than the Constituent Assembly, if he had been able to carry it out, would have consolidated it through popular processes, a new constitution, new elections for presidential office, well, Congress or whatever they call it, the National Assembly. And this would have been a platform for fundamental reform, and he would have been a strong ally of this growing axis of powers in Latin America.
Now, the only person you didn't mention in this little range, well, not the only one, but one is Daniel Ortega. Where does he fit on your spectrum, which I agree with you? You have these four leftist countries, including, or new left countries, including Cuba. Then you have the reformist countries, which you mentioned. And where does our friend Daniel Ortega of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua fit in?
Daniel Ortega has carried out very strong international policy. He also is becoming, or has now joined, the members of ELBA, Bolivarian Alternative for Latin America, the new trade agreement led by Cuba, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia, with Dominica. And Nicaragua is in the process, or has already consolidated it. I believe it has already formally joined ALBA. Honduras has entered it also. Well, Daniel Ortega has maintained a strong anti-imperialist policy, primarily because the U.S. has cut him off from funding. But he has been very authoritarian process, very dictatorial internally, has alienated the most progressive Sandinistas like Dora Maria Teles, who leads a lot of social movement activity in the country. And so internally, he's become a very repressive authoritarian figure.
Roger, if Zelaya does return, is he in any physical danger?
Who knows? Most likely they would like to just arrest him, but we can never tell with these coup leaders what they've been instructed to, what sector of the CIA they might be working with, what would go on. Anything is possible. That by getting him involved in the negotiating process, he will cease in the interim period from trying to carry out any return to Nicaragua. It's a way of co-opting. The longer the U.S. and the Honduran de facto regime can drag this out, the better it is for them. The closer they get to the elections in November, they can argue these just should go over. Of course, be controlled and rigged elections under state of siege virtually. But the longer they can delay the elections, the more traction they gain internally. The U.S. is the only country which has not suspended economic relations, and nor has it withdrawn its ambassador, whereas virtually most of the other Latin American countries have done so.
Well, Roger, that's a good place to end this, because that tells us really what the U.S. real position is here.
The bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, which is controlled basically by the Organization of American States, the World Bank, and even the IMF have all suspended economic assistance. The U.S. government has not suspended economic assistance.
Roger, why don't you give our listeners just where we can find your articles? I know it's NACLA, but tell them what the website is and where they can read some of your material.
The materials are on at globalalternatives.org.
Well, thank you, Roger. I know you've been doing this for, I don't know, how many years? 30, 40? What is it?
30 years, the year before its 30th anniversary.
Well, thank you very much, Roger.
Thanks, Roger.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.